So, first of all, I want to thank particularly Flavio for here and my colleagues from Campus Brugnatico Rome, and Riccardo Rispaia, with whom we worked together on this stuff, and also Flavio recently has joined. So basically, where I am, I'm here. This is Italy, Rome, and we are just 15 kilometers from St. Peter. So it's in the countryside, as you can see, countryside of Rome, but this is our lab. The head is Simonetta Felitti, many of you know, and this is the current people involved. And the lab is named Nonlinear Physics and Mathematical Modeling. So in particular, the main theme is cardiac dynamics, and I'm gonna talk about electromechanics today. But we have to start a little bit from general active deformable media, because it turns out that in chemistry, and particularly in polymers, it's very well known, this coupling between the mechanics and ion dynamics. And in fact, if you look in the literature, there are tons of books actually going towards soft robotics for real application, artificial muscles and something like that, using these principles. On this idea, of course, all our body is full of active deformable tissues, particular cells, and the same theoretical formulation I'm gonna talk about today can be applied to all the other meat tissues. We already know, of course, I know many any review, but I should point out the mechanical part of the story, because I don't know how you are familiar with the mechanics in this context. So basically, the calcium wave is gonna excite the contractility of the tissue, but the tissue itself has its own mechanical response. And in particular, if you consider the heart ex vivo from the experiment, I mean, in the lab, and you stretch it, you're gonna get this response. The blue one is a passive response. It's like an hyperelastic material, like a rubber-like material. But it turns out that since it's active, and if you excite it, it contracts. Basically, you have also the red part of the story, which means that at the resting length, so in the physiological conditions, there's the maximum force that the muscle can exert. If you stretch it or if you compress it, this force goes down. Why? Because the overlap between actin and myosin proteins is not optimum. It means that if you stretch the proteins, they cannot overlap. If you compress, they can overlap either. So the active part is gonna decrease along the stress or compression, but the total response now is the combination of these two phenomena. So it's a passive plus an active contribution. From the mechanical point of view, this is not trivial. It's absolutely non-trivial, and there are different approaches I'm gonna just mention. But before going in the theoretical approaches, I want to motivate why atria in particular is well known, all the different mechanoelectric feedbacks that induce arrhythmogenesis. Basically, you can observe early after depolarization, when you stretch the atria, or you can observe a slowdown of the conduction velocity, as well as the increase of the refractory period. But more important probably is the reduction of the action potential when you inflate the atrium. You see, as you increase the amount of pressure inside, the action potential gets shorter, and the inducibility of fibrillation is basically 100%. So here you have AF inducibility percentage, and this is the pressure you impose for the inflation. Basically, you go up to 100%. So it's sure that if the atrium is fully inflated too much, you get fibrillation. But it's very complex, because it turns out that if you then increase and decrease the pressure, the system comes back to normal rhythm. So it seems to be a reversible system. So it's not as obvious as we should model this behavior. And there is a wonderful review from Ravelli. So this is just an idea of how you make these experiments. So
There is hysteresis,
but also in the ventricle. Just the passive material is hysteretic. Only the passive material, just to the ex vivo without excitation. So in the active part, it's going to be even more complex, but there is.
Do you also see a shortening of ABD in the ventricle if you stretch like that?
That's not trivial to observe. It's much more complex.
You see the opposite in the ventricle.
In the ventricle, it seems to be the opposite when you stretch it. Okay, I'm not aware of those data, but these data come mainly from atrium. So that's something we can discuss.
And is there a species dependence to this?
I think so, but I'm not aware of that. I mean, these, since what I remember, these should be rabbits. These should be rabbits. But I don't know if there is a strong correlation between species or not.
You perfuse these tissues during these?
These are not my experiments, but this is perfused art. Yes. I mean, it's beating. Okay, so it turns out that all these behaviors are very complex. In particular, you seem to have a reduction of the CV, of the wavelength, but at the same time, the dispersion of CV increases, heterogeneous increases, and so on and so forth. But and all these evidences are not one-to-one. Someone says that, for example, there is an increase of the conduction velocity, many of them say that there's a decrease of the conduction velocity, so it really depends on the case. But there is a variation for sure, at least of the conduction velocity. So in mechanical terms, basically there are very complex theories to end up with this problem. The idea is to treat the actin myosin binding as a microstructural alteration of the tissue. And this means that the kinematic state is going to change according to all the ionic dynamics we are modeling. So there are two main approaches in the literature. The first one is called the active stress approach, Nash and Pankhill of 2004. Second one has been named active strain, is based on the multiplicity decomposition of the deformation gradient. And we end up to derive both approaches from thermodynamics. So if you use a fully thermodynamic approach, you can derive both active stress and active strain. And for a proof of concept, I'm going to talk about the active stress approach in the simulations, in which basically the total stress you have in the tissue is the superposition of a passive stress, the blue curve, and an active stress, the red curve. But the limitation of this approach is that it does comes from thermodynamic arguments. It's a little bit more involved to describe this, but it's very easy to implement. So in numerical code, it's really straightforward. Now, these evidences actually come back from Landau, because in the infinitesimal electrodynamics already was described how the diffusion in solids depend on the strain that you have in the solids. And this is in the book, the infinitesimal case. But and the literature in the early 80s ended up with the so-called theory of stress-assisted diffusion. Ifantis and co-authors, they generalized the ideas that Landau was pointing out in a finite deformation settings. And this is basically a theory that has been developed for porous materials. So in porous materials, this is very much evident. And these two effects, that the stress is supported by diffusing species and there is a diffusive force, these are two components that interact in the porous material, are not accounted for the classical diffusion. In the classical diffusion equation, the cable equation, whatever, you don't have these two effects. And just to give you how we end up with this idea, basically I made this homemade proof of concept. You get a cleaning sponge and you put a dye on the table and you get something which is circular, right? Spherical. If you stretch it and you put a dye, you get something which is more ellipsoidal. Okay? So this is obvious. It's a porous material, right? So we want to use this approach in the heart. And actually, thanks to Flavio that has done not a consistently amount of experiment. This is the first one. So basically, also Ilya helped him. If you don't stretch, this is a ventricle, by the way. If you don't stretch the tissue, you have this activation, isochrones and activation. If you stretch horizontally or vertically, you have this activation. So it seems that there is an enhanced anisotropy in the tissue, and rough estimates, you cannot read, but there is a slowdown of the conduction velocity. In particular, this is 0.4, 0.3, 0.3. It's a rough estimate not in the peak, but in the median value. The peak is even lower. Okay. Now, how we end up with a consistent theory that we can apply to the heart.
Can you apply the stretch? Can you explain how you pull the tissue? Mm-hmm.
Flavio.
So we're designing a system that is more robust, but we don't know, we just pull it. This is preliminary.
He should set up a very consistent experiment.
We set up something, but it was not really pushing back strong enough, so that we just pull and make sure we put some we put it down, but just put it we put some measurements to make sure.
The measurement is, by the way, is consistent. It's repetitive under 15 activations, is always the same.
And it was steady state.
Yeah, I have the evidence.
And how do you measure the conduction velocity in that space? Or
the conduction velocity is measured along these directions because it's a local measure. So basically, these histograms are the measures that you have at each isochron along this direction, and it turns out that the median value is lower. The conduction velocity is slowed down.
And fiber direction is along that line?
No, we don't know.
No, we stretch it, and it was not a stretch on the
side. But this is a horizontal stretch and vertical stretch. So in both cases.
Do you measure pixel-based or 3D?
Yeah. We have a 128 by 128. It's the usual field of view for the optical mapping.
But we got new cameras with that.
But this was...
No, this is... Yeah,
it's not
a new camera.
Okay, so it seems reasonable that there is this effect. Now, how we model it. Okay, we have to, thanks to this generalized theory for porous materials, we can use the balance of momentum. And this is really important in mechanics, otherwise we don't know how to write the equilibrium equation. So basically, in this stress-assisted diffusion approach, you can handle diffusion in stress solid if there is a viscous solute, and even though there are elastic or anelastic materials. And in particular, electromechanics, when you use the multiplicity decomposition, turns out to be in the anelastic material behavior. So, in order to write a balance, we need to assume that the voltage is a continuum field. And this is always what we assume with the cable equation. Then we also need to assume that there's a slow diffusion and the matrix is macroscopically rigid. These two assumptions are basically always done in electromechanics because the acceleration part of the tissue is not considered. So it means that the diffusion of the voltage is much lower than the contraction waves, the mechanical waves, sorry. And that basically the matrix is always at equilibrium. Okay, so it's macroscopically rigid every time. Now, with this assumption, we can prove that the response is the diffusion process strongly depends on the mechanical state of the tissue. And I will show you some very toy model example in which this is true. Okay, I don't want to go through all the details, but just to give you an idea, this is the most general form of the local of the mass and momentum balances that you can write for these materials. And here you have the density, which in general, in our case, is going to be the voltage. So the diffusing substance, the velocity, supply. Then you're going to have the stress in the substance itself, body forces, diffusive forces, and acceleration. So these are all the possible components you can put in the balances. Now, if we make some simplification hypotheses, which are pretty much obvious. So the diffusive species does not support shear stress, and only the hydrostatic component of the stress will affect the diffusive species, so only the pressure, basically. Then you can get rid of several of those components. And what we want, what's the object of our study? Is the flux, J, the flux of the substance. Now, in order to end up with the constitutive prescription for the flux, we need to use a theorem, which is called the representation theorem for second-order tensors, and says that any tensor, second-order tensor, can be expressed in terms of its invariants. Okay, basically, these are the three principal invariants of the tensor, and this is a linear combination, or eventually a linear combination, according to S, which S is the stress in the solid, not the stress in the diffusive species. It's the stress in the solid. Now, if you put this assumption in the equations, you end up with this flux, which is pretty complex. There is another assumption that we always make in electromechanics for soft tissue, which is incompressibility. Incompressibility means that the volume is preserved. So, sorry, this trace of the stress is going to be constant, so its gradient is going to be zero, so we can get rid of this. And we end up with the so-called stress-assisted diffusion equation, which is this guy. The flux is a function of the stress multiplying the gradient of the field, or if you use the strain measure, you can equivalently write the flux as a function of the strain multiplying the gradient of the field. So this is absolutely equivalent if you are in hyperelastic materials in which there is a one-to-one relationship between stress and strain. Of course, more complex material would be more involved, but this is what you get. Now, this is a general picture. Let's apply the...
So, I mean, I was under the impression that if you're talking about incompressibility, you need to have something like the pressure in order to enforce the incompressibility, because the hydrostatic pressure. The second equation.
Yeah.
So I'm confused that you're crossing.
Sorry,
the
I was too fast. This is hypothesis, the hydrostatic component acting on the diffusive species. This is the incompressibility of the matrix.
Okay, so that's my other question, I guess. Is the diffusive species you're thinking, what are you thinking about there?
You think that the diffusive species is affecting only by the pressure. So if you have in mind pores with diffusive species inside, basically the pressure inside the pore is the only component that allows the diffusing species to pass through. While this one is related to the solid, to the matrix. And the matrix is supposed to be incompressible.
Okay, so your diffusive species is with a
It's the voltage in our case.
It's the voltage, okay.
In our case, it's going to be the voltage.
Okay, and then, all right.
So basically, how we apply this theory to the simplest case possible, and actually, we wanted to exactly get the same model as Nash and Pamphilov done in 2004 to compare exactly what's going on. Okay, so this is a 2D reaction diffusion system in which you have the classical bistable function in the linear recovery dynamics. This is the active stress component, which has a simple dynamics, the basic. And this is the equilibrium. So the equilibrium is a passive stress plus an active stress. We use exactly the same approach, so it's a near Hookahn material, which is this form, plus an active contribution. So everything else was already known. What we introduce? We introduce the stress-assisted diffusion. So our new diffusion tensor, Dij, this guy over here, is a function of the stress and the square of the stress. Exactly as I derived before. So if I go back one slide, this is identity tensor, stress, the square of the stress, multiplying the gradient of the field. It's going to be diffusion tensor multiplying the gradient of the voltage. Exactly the same. So this is the diffusion tensor multiplying the gradient of the voltage.
I mean, you also have the dependence of the diffusion on this terrain. You don't have a stress. I mean, just imagine, you know, you have cells that you deform, you know, the density of gap junctions, you know, changes as you deform the material, so, you know, the conductivity in the different directions is going to change.
Yeah. You mean if the boundaries are stress-free everywhere and I inflate a cell and it changes the volume? This is your experiment in mind?
Basically, because what I'm saying is that there is a dependence that doesn't include the stress in the cell.
Well,
just because of the fact that there is this non-zero strength.
Well, let's say if you have a bar of metal which is hot, and you leave it on a table, is stress-free, even though it deforms, and that's what the strains are.
But I mean, it's not the same problem, right? So we're talking about, in this case, about the conductivity that has to do with the internal structure.
You mean intracellular?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's going to be, I mean, this is a homogenized approach, of course, but, I mean, as I told you, in principle, this one can be framed or in terms of stresses or in terms of strains. It's a matter, I mean, if I replace here sigma ij with epsilon ij, I am going to have two material parameters, okay? And these ones, they're going to enter the diffusion tensor. So is one or the other?
Yeah, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I don't understand what the derivation you got. I can understand one for the polymer, for some continuous, real continuous system. When you stretch, you change the density and you change the diffusion in different directions. But the heart is not a continuum, it's a discretized, because the cell has a boundary. So the coupling is not really a diffusion system. It's coupled by gap junctions. Mm-hmm. So when you stretch the tissue, I don't know how you change the diffusion in terms of this contraction, because unless the gap junctions, the number of gap junctions changes between cells, then you can change the diffusion, you know, between two cells. We don't know whether this is true or not. If you're under the assumption that the gap junction doesn't change, the voltage, you know, the polarization from cell to cell, whether you have a stretch or not, it shouldn't change.
Well, what you're talking about is an open...
Because the gap junction is conserved between cells.
Well, okay.
I mean, I cannot make this assumption. It depends on really whether the stress changes the gap junction or not.
Okay, this is absolutely a good question. It's an open question. We don't know. We don't know if under stretch we are locally changing the connections. But for sure, when you use the cable equation, you are homogenizing.
Yeah, but whatever, the nervous system might not.
Well, whatever you use, okay, you are homogenizing because the gap junctions are 2 nanometers long. And you want to reproduce the behavior of 5 centimeters. So you are homogenizing. It's a multi-scale problem. So as before. So basically, we don't know what's going on in terms of strain dependency on the gap junctions. There are no experimental evidences that I know that can measure those dependencies. But for sure, if the membrane, the cell membrane, is going to change, right, because you deform the cell, the surface to volume ratio is going to change. So any effect that is homogenizing the diffusion tensor is going to affect the diffusion tensor, right? If I stretch the cell, the surface to volume ratio is going to change, and that is going to affect the diffusivity in the homogenized behavior, in the cable equation, right? If you derive the cable equation for a cylinder, but you consider the radius as a surface to volume effect, is going to be inside the divergence. So it means that there is a length dependency inside here, which is homogenized. We don't know. I mean, so, I don't know the answer, but there is an effect over there.
So you're taking into account the conductivity within the cells, not just, you know.
Absolutely.
That's comparable to the
How deep we want to go? I mean, we can go up to the actin-myosin process, and then, but how we simulate that? Okay, it's how you end up with a formula that you can homogenize and you can simulate in the real tissue. It's an open question. I was working a little bit also in trying to make an homogenization on a cable with different connection gate junctions. I mean, it's not trivial. It's not known at the moment. But this should hold from thermodynamical arguments, right?
You might be able to argue that you're half right, because it seems like the geometry of the cell, that part of it seems like it'd be, you know, that's kind of reasonable, and that's half of the resistance that's being put into this diffusivity tensor, right? And the other half comes from the gap junctions. You don't know what happens with those. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, of course.
It kind of half, or maybe less than half.
Because I heard it was around a half. That they're both equally contribute.
I saw it's less, much less in the internal one. It's much less than the.
Also much larger. You know, I mean, the gap junction is this big, contributes, you know, such and such number of ohms, and then this other thing, which is much longer, also contributes about the same number of ohms, but it's much longer.
The diffusion coefficient value, that's what you calculate. You calculate the resistance of the cell, but also the surface to volume ratio.
Which then contributes to the, you know, the conductance.
It's by there in the diffusion sort of, yeah.
Sorry, there was a question.
Sorry, it's a very simple question. I just missed the important detail. You constitute me the Lagrangian correlation, or
okay. Thanks for the question, because I erased that part. Okay, this one is written in the current configuration because this is what we know, okay? But the solution is pulled back in the reference configuration, so it's purely Lagrangian. So in the numerical simulations, we have frame invariance.
Formula for the diffusion will depend on which system.
Absolutely. Also, this is the special. So this is the Cauchy stress. So it's the one we measure. The Cauchy stress is in the material, the deformed configuration. This is what we write over here. But in order to numerically solve it, we have to pull back in the reference configuration. So there is frame invariance, and there we can solve the equations. I erased the slide.
This discussion about what contributes to the diffusion tensor, it will have different meaning depending on which frame you're using.
Yes.
So if you're talking about Lagrangian formulation, then if you say don't have any intracellular resistivity, so each cell is potential, then all the resistivity is due to the gap junctions. And if the gap junctions are fixed, then in the Lagrangian formulation, your diffusion tensor will not depend on definition at all.
No, this is the current.
And if you do the other way around, if you assume that the gap junctions don't contribute and you have the, all the resistivity due to intracellular medium resistivity, then it may be simplistic, but to a large extent, you may imagine that it doesn't depend on deformation at all because it's the same liquid, you only change it. So in Eulerian formulation, the diffusion tensor will not change.
The derivation?
All the changes will happen in either because only if you have some contribution from one and some from the other.
Okay.
Until you fix which reference you're talking about.
You're absolutely right. The derivation of the stress-assisted diffusion is done under frame invariance conditions. Okay, so that those conditions ensure you that you can manipulate this object exactly as in this way. Otherwise, you cannot do that because if you don't have frame invariance, you cannot impose equilibrium in your stress. And you cannot solve it.
So this is the covariant form, but the actual numbers will depend.
Will depend on yes.
I was going to say that there is another mechanism of coupling in addition to gap junction, and called factor coupling. And people publish it, and they said that most important role they play. They are very small contribution, but they can play a major role under stress condition, whenever gap junctions are reduced in ischemic disease.
Yeah.
That can be one of the.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, there are several facts, but absolutely, I'm happy to discuss about this. So basically, the reaction diffusion equations are generalized. So we generalize the fixed equation. This is a generalization of fixed equation. And we are not considering stretched currents at the moment. So only stress-assisted diffusion. What we get is let's make some theoretical assumptions. So this is a two-dimensional tissue and we stretch it, uniaxial. When you stretch it, this is the stress, the logarithm form is a stress that you have within this two-dimensional tissue. So what we can assume is that inside, in the green area, you basically have only the two principal components of the stress because basically, this is a uniaxial state. These two guys, we're going to enter into the diffusion tensor, and we have to ensure that the diffusion tensor stays positive. Otherwise, we will get diffusion back in time, right? So we need ensure ellipticity of the tensor. If you do that, what do you observe? You put some one number, whatever number over there, and you see that this in the parameter space d1, d2, in blue is the only region that fulfills this condition. So this is just a theoretical study, but if you actually calculate the stress in the different points, and you put back the values of the stress inside the diffusion tensor, you have that this region is the one that allows you to fulfill this condition. Now, these are still theoretical assumptions because it's not true that this is also effectively. But what we've done is a numerical study. So basically, we initiate a target pattern within the stretched tissue. And we measure the horizontal and vertical conduction velocity. The two velocities are plotted in this graph in the same d1, d2, as the ratio between, you cannot read, but it's cvx over cvy. So it's the ratio between the two conduction velocities. It turns out that in white, there are the same conditions in which you cannot have the propagation of the wave, while all the others allow you to propagate the target pattern. And what I mean is the following, is that if you put 0, 0, you basically have a target pattern. If you increase the components, it becomes more and more anisotropic. And these cases are the ones in which you basically, from here, you have only propagation in this direction, but you don't have any propagation in this direction. So it means that those parameters that don't fulfill the ellipticity condition. Okay. Now, this is just a preliminary study, and how, I mean, but more or less, if there is an enhanced anisotropy, it seems something like this. This should be the effect. We also studied the dynamics of the spiral in the stretch state. So again, if you go back to the Nash and Pamphilov approach, basically the spiral stays there. So D1 and D2, zero, and the spiral is going to stay there forever. While if you slightly introduce D1 and D2, it's going to drift. From here, it's going to go down. As well as if you use too high values, the spirals totally disappear because you are totally changing the anisotropy of the tissue. So it seems that a medium range of value is the one that should be used, at least in a preliminary study. And if you observe here, this range corresponds to the blue and dark blue regions in which we have a slightly slowdown of the conduction velocity. So it seems that if we are increasing the conduction velocity, that's too much. But if the conduction velocity slows down a little bit, as in the experiments, we reproduce something which should be reasonable.
How does the spiral terminate?
Sorry.
How does the spiral terminate on the right side? Or
this one?
Or you cannot generate spiral out?
No, this one, soon after, it goes out from the domain. So basically, there's so much anisotropy that it goes so fast that goes out from the domain.
Do you suddenly die at the boundary?
Yeah, yeah. The Neumann boundary conditions, yes.
In the previous slide, you did the... Yes, this one.
This one?
Yeah. So in the experiment, doesn't depend on the direction of the stretch, right? It will go the same direction. Is that
no, it's not exactly one-to-one because we don't know exactly the direction of the fibers, but there is a slightly different distribution of the velocities.
Yes, that means in the real heart, if the fiber is fixed, whatever you stretch this way or the other way, the elongation is always the same.
No,
right?
No.
Is that that's
no,
the
no,
first
slide? No. No. It's slightly different.
But so, okay. Yeah,
this is a preliminary study, but this horizontal stretch and vertical
right.
stretch.
So I don't see any. I see the elongation, but I didn't see the change in directions of the elongation.
No, in fact, there is not a big change in the direction.
Is that can you simulate that in your model?
Yes, but the simulations there were. The purpose was to explore all the possible parameter space and see what are the reasonable values that we should put in there.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering is this must be a very strong structural dependent.
Absolutely. I totally agree. If I put in the simulations all the structure, the anisotropy and so on is going to change a lot. But the effect, in principle, has to be there, right? I'll get to another evidence for that. Okay, so this is the spiral drift. Then we try to simulate a mechanical pacing, right, with a sinusoidal variation of the boundary. And basically, we study the dynamics, the spiral meandering, and this is what you get. So exactly the same mechanical state. If you change, of course, the D1, D2 components, you're going to have or a localized spiral, as in the Nash and Pamphilov case, or the meandering is going to become totally chaotic and eventually it's going to go out from the tissue. So this means that there is a strong effect. Now, the point is how to validate this, and it was one of the open questions I put in the end, but at least we know that there is this coupling. But we did another analysis, which is introducing also a minimal model for stretch activity currents, so to compare the two effects together. So again, as in the Nash-Pamphilov case, this is the minimum of the minimum that you can put as a stretch activity current. And again, it's pretty complex because this is the parameter space for D1 and GS. We fixed D2, okay? So in this parameter space, if we only change GS, and GS is stretch activity currents, this is the conduction velocity in color, the conduction velocity grows. Okay? So I'm only changing from A to C the GS value, and the conduction velocity grows, so it seems to be counterintuitive with respect to the experiments. If I only change D1, the conduction velocity decreases. Of course, there's, in general, there could be a combination of the two, so eventually we should move along this path. But there are cases in which we cannot even measure the conduction velocity. And in particular, when GS is too high, when the stretch activity currents are too high, this is the behavior. For example, here you generate a plane wave, but from the two corners, since the stretch activity currents are too high, you generate counter waves, and basically everything dies out. Okay. Or in this other case, the stretch activity currents are so high that all the tissue gets instantaneously activated. So there are a lot of competing mechanisms going around over here.
I mean, how do you even define the conduction velocity? I mean, your stresses are getting all over the place.
Excuse me?
Your stress is completely different in different regions.
Yes.
So your conduction velocity should also be, in principle, different in different regions.
Absolutely true. But in this case, we consider as the center of the domain as... Of course, I have a slide to show you how it's going to be different, the stress in each position. But this is true also for the original approach, actually. But the effect, the coupling is much smaller.
Well, it does depend on the value to show D sat too, right? Yeah.
This was exactly the same parameter set from Nash and Pamphilov. We want to just to compare the same model, just to see what's going on. But we can change the Isaac model with more physiological ones and see what's happening.
So what is the value of the VSAC?
I don't remember. I should go to the paper, but it's exactly...
If it's higher than minus 80, then it could slow your conduction.
This is a phenomenological model, so it's... Of course, it's the minimum of the minimum. This has to be improved with more physiological.
It doesn't have even refractory field.
No.
The stretch activity channel, when you touch the heart, you can stimulate it periodically at a certain period, but if you go too fast, it will not activate. Like when you do an electron. With an electron, you can pace up really, really fast, right? 100 milliseconds or faster. Touching, if your stretch, you can activate it, but if you do more than a second, more faster than a second, you will not do anything. This is the
minimum that you can use, but it's just for a preliminary comparison.
So these are going to be higher.
It may be high, but also it has to have a time-dependent activation, inactivation.
Okay, so it's own model. I mean, it's own dynamics. What I want to stress here is that if you change the boundary conditions from displacement to stress boundary conditions, you can even get more complex behavior because of the localization of the conduction velocity. Here, we selected these four combination of parameters, And we compare the static displacement with the dynamic displacement, static traction and dynamic traction. And these are the meandering of the spirals we get. So basically, it seems that for these parameters, the stress-assisted diffusion stabilizes the meandering, while the stretch activity currents destabilized it. So in blue and red are always the cases in which we have high GS. And of course, this is again a toy model. But there are some cases, you see for here, then the spiral goes out from the domain directly. So that's no meandering anymore. So to conclude, we generalize the reaction diffusion system with two mechanoelectric feedbacks. One is known, and the other one is the we brought from porous medium. In one case, we modify the diffusion, in the other, the reaction. This, to me, is homogenized. This, to me, is local, okay, in the PDE, in terms of the PDE. But in principle, this leads to anisotropy and conduction block, because there are cases which the wave cannot propagate because of the so strong anisotropy. This leads to extra activation, as I showed you in the corner, there are localization, that you have extra activation. And there could be hyperpolarization everywhere if the stretch activity currents are too high. So this could be wave break and arrhythmias, and this could be ectopic beats and arrhythmias, but it's just a possibility. We need to generalize the medium to anisotropic, so to introduce the structure, as was mentioned before, and to use a more refined physiological description of the ionic part. What I think is a very challenging question, as Johannes was pointing out, how to go from cell-cell coupling to the tissue scale when we have the mechanics. We have done some simulations at electromechanics of single cell or cell-cell interaction, in which we used a mechanical and a nonlinear electrical boundary. But this is still there's a long way before we can validate this. So any help is welcome. And let me finish with this one. I like this sentence, and I think, especially in this context, it's totally true. We are still trying.
Very nice talk, please, Alessio. About this diffusion part, do I understand right that the anisotropy in block appears when the deformation is large enough? So if it is small, it just leads to a meandering and perhaps drift from the center towards the boundary, or is it the other way around?
In our case, we fix the deformation, so it means we fix the stress value and we change the parameters in the model. But of course, once you fix the parameter and you change the stress, it's going to be the same.
It's just a thought that if it's about the diffusion, then the result may depend on the parameter in the following sense. If you choose the parameters at which the filament tension is positive or negative, it will have exactly opposite effects of this deformation. Simply because filament tension, mathematically speaking, is equivalent to changing the diffusion tensor in some sense.
Yeah, but the filament tension, I mean, is a
three-dimensional phenomenon. You're doing
yes,
the,
but
I appreciate that. That's what I'm saying. Mathematically equivalent.
Mathematically equivalent, though there is a, as was pointed out before, a strong effect of the heterogeneity here, and is this
but
one.
When you're doing 2D, you're affecting. You're putting a gradient on the first derivative, right? That affects the dynamics, right? That's why it was called one direction or the other direction.
Yes.
It's not just a Laplacian, you also have a convection.
Well, yes.
Term, right?
But in your simulations, you have heterogeneity of the diffusion tensor.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the deformation.
In fact, this is what you get with the usual electromechanics approach. So this is you solve an eigenvalue eigenvector problems and you plot what is called the tensorial leaf representation. So each sphere is depends on the eigenvalue in the.
So there is a gradient of the diffusion tensor.
Yeah, there is.
This one way will react to that gradient depending on the filament tension.
Yes,
absolutely. This one way or the opposite way.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you this is the stress, and this is the overall effect when you put the stress into the tensor. So as you see, this is in the reference frame. So
I'm just saying that it's worth checking.
Yeah, yeah.
The tension and whether you can change it.
Absolutely, absolutely true.
Did you?
Nils.
I'm sorry.
Me? Nils.
I didn't quite get from you whether you found that the conduction velocity is faster in the direction you're stretching, or is it slower in your simulations?
In the simulations, the conduction velocity depends on the parameters. So if let me go back to the slide.
I guess intuitively to me it seems like it would be slower because...
You mean this one, right? So here, we measure the two in this one, you mean, or the... So we measure the conduction velocity between these two points for the horizontal propagation and these two points for the vertical propagation. So according to the parameters you use, there are cases in which the vertical direction is never reached by the wave. And this means that we are violating the ellipticity condition with those parameters. They are too high because the stress, in principle, could be negative. So you are adding to an the identity tensor something that could be negative. So if you go below zero, you're going to violate the condition. So for some of the parameters, you cannot use... you cannot use those parameters. Now the question is how to validate those parameters. So we need a lot of experiments in order to check every time.
Now let me ask you a slightly technical question.
Sorry, there was a question before. I'm sorry.
Well, anyway, I hear somebody's talking. Oh, okay, so
you were talking.
Okay. Yeah, the spiral dynamics is beautiful, but I just wondering, do you have any physiological disease condition can have a stretch and have a spiral wave in it in the heart? What physiological disease conditions were corresponding to that spiral wave scenario?
As I mentioned you in the beginning, if the atria is inflated too much, it goes in fibrillation. So there could be
an experimental observation. From where?
Those are from experiments.
Right. So we said, what's the physiological disease scenario?
I don't know, but for sure, but for sure that effect has to be present because of the changing of the conduction.
I don't know that this result is true, that if you inflate the atrium, you get an arrhythmia.
No. Atrial fibrillation. What? There's a model to induce atrial fibrillation and they inflate.
But how long does it take?
Oh, it's acute model. It's not chronic.
Mm. And on what animal is that?
It's in dog, definitely in dogs, I know. There's a model how to induce atrial
fibrillation. But it's not logical. Where does that happen?
Well, they need to induce atrial fibrillation sometimes.
Oh, but what?
I don't know. The size of the left atrium is the biggest predictor of the outcome of atrial fibrillation ablation. The larger left atrium is, the lowest toxicity that you have. So in a sense, that's correct. But we're talking about the end-diastolic end-isoph dimension, or end-isoph ventricular dimension, the larger size of left atrium of the epsilon. So that's associated with atrial fibrillation.
Sorry, I will interrupt you before.
So my question is about sort of the scales of numbers. the strain is dimensional less, the stress is dimensional.
Yeah.
So depending upon sort of what the scale is, or the, if you use to express your stress in,
yeah,
those numbers will
yeah,
come out.
Those are,
right?
So, those have dimensions, of course.
So your stress is what, I mean, unless you specify the units, right? So, you know, none of this really makes
sense. Absolutely true. I mean, as I was telling you, you can use both a stress-dependent diffusion tensor or a strain-dependent diffusion tensor. In this case, we wanted to use the stress because in the literature was named stress-assisted diffusion. But we can do exactly the same with the strain. The parameters are going to be non-dimensional. The parameter space is going to be slightly different because, of course, there are going to be non-linearities because the material is non-linear, but the physical principle is there.
But I mean, there is a relevant number there, which is the characteristic, basically, which essentially, well, basically Young's modulus or the analog of the Young's modulus. That comes in, right? So that's basically it's another parameter.
The passive material, you mean? The passive material, yes, of course. But this goes into the electrophysiology. These parameters, they go into the electrophysiology. The passive material is in the stress, in the equilibrium equation, right?
No, but I mean the numbers for D1, D2 will depend on basically what choice for the Young's modulus you make.
Let's say if you change the material model, it's like if you change the electrophysiological model. In general, you have to tune the parameters.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is not really, you know, these numbers, they're not really trying to represent anything other than just to show sort of, you know, on the qualitative levels of what you have.
Yeah, this is qualitative. Absolutely, I agree. But the important thing is, at least to me, is that there are a range of parameters in which you have a slowdown of the conduction loss. And this is what you should expect to reproduce, at least. Then we can make the model better, physiologically relevant, with all the physical dimensions you want. There are physical dimensions, but they are not relevant in this case. And then validate the model for the specific case. So you get that species, you get the material properties for the passive behavior, you get the activation for the excitation, whatever, and then you tune the parameters. But the theoretical framework is going to be exactly the same. Nothing's going to change.
Mathematical question. For your DIJ, why don't you have at second order a third term proportional to the product of trace of sigma, sigma IJ?
Because those are the only terms that survive when you use this theorem. So basically, there is a theorem from Spencer in the 70s. It's called the representation theorem for second-order tensors, and it demonstrates that if you have a second-order tensor, the maximum combination that you need to reproduce it is this one. So we don't need S to the third.
That says that you cannot have anything beyond second order in a functional form, which I find hard to believe.
Well, the point is that the derivation here is from thermodynamics and from balance laws. So you have to respect those laws. Then if you prescribe another energy, then your energy can be whatever. But since we don't have an energy derived that from where we can derive it, we have to acknowledge the theorems. Otherwise, if I put something else over here, I'm not respecting the hypothesis over which I draw the balances. Well, yeah, that's a point of if we can prescribe a Lagrangian or not. But in this case, we cannot.
So, I guess what I found a little troubling is the relationship between what you showed here, the Frank Starling law of the heart, where you have active and passive forces, And at a certain point, if you go past a certain length, you start to have a decrement in active force because of cross-bridge overlap. And when you apply this very well-known cardiac feature, which is well-established, it's the 1700s, you have to apply the stretch exactly along the axis of the actin and myosin system. And when you apply that, you report a shortening of action potential duration in the atrium and a slower conduction velocity. So both of these are going to be exceedingly arrhythmogenic because you're changing the cycle length of propagation and a reentrant circuit. No problem. If you now consider what an atrial tissue is, it's a mishmash of many, many different directions. The pectinate muscles come off at angles that are 90 degrees perpendicular. You can never apply this rule in a clear fashion to an atrial tissue.
At all. Absolutely.
So the link between the stretch and the arrhythmia here becomes tenuous. It's not such a clear-cut relationship. And many other factors can go into this arrhythmia.
Absolutely. That's why I mentioned that it's a complex problem. It's not only that, but that physical principle has to be there. At the moment, we don't know how important it is, but we should study it. At least this is my point of view, and I like to understand more why that should be important or not. But it's also true that everyone is using stretch activity currents, right? Everywhere, I mean, in any three-dimensional cardiac electromechanics model, stretch activity currents. Up to which point they are true, I don't know. So it's the same, exactly the same question for the stress-assisted diffusion. But at least the stress-assisted diffusion comes from a balanced law, while the active stress, sorry, the stretch activity currents, they are assumed to be there without any balance. At least that's what I know. So it's something that I think is interesting to work on, at least to understand why it should be there or not.
But in coming back to this issue, you basically have another sensor in the problem, right? So you're basically looking at an isotropic material in your formulation, which is not.
In deformulation, the tissue is isotropic in the beginning.
The point is that it's not isotropic.
Absolutely.
In the right?
No. I totally agree. In fact, we are working in generalized theory for anisotropic material to put rotational anisotropy, whatever you want. But the theory is already there and it's already generalized. So there are not so big deals if your tissue is anisotropic or not.
But I mean, then. You can't really write, your expressions in terms of invariance are going to change, right?
The expression, you can approximate because you can have a passive material which is anisotropic, so it's a function of higher order invariance in the passive material, but the active contribution could not. I mean, or the stress-assisted contribution could not. There are approximations there. But we are working exactly in that direction because was one of the points that said is isotropic, but should be anisotropic, should be also heterogeneous, but the heterogeneity is not a problem because locally it could be different, but sure, anisotropism.
So in your introduction you showed the EAD due to stretch.
Excuse me?
You showed the EAD?
Yeah.
In your introduction? Can you explain this phenomenon?
It's the same question as before. We don't know exactly if this is due to stretch activity currents or to the combination of stretch activity currents and stress-assisted diffusion. Probably this one is likely due to SAC, while the anisotropy is due to SED. But this is just my idea. It has to be confirmed on the experiments.
Are there experiments with the tarantula toxin to block the sac?
See
if these go away?
I don't know, but I think so. I don't know. I'm not aware of it.